Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have two published novels. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. My latest is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. My previous novel is titled Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. Both of those novels are listed in the episode notes. Now, on with our program.
This is Mike Consul, your host. In the spotlight is Katie Hayes, a California writer and a cake aficionado. We're going to find out if she watches the British Baking Show. I suspect she does. And we're also going to find out what her favorite cake is, because I think you can tell a lot about a person by what they eat. I mean, a pound cake is a mile away from something like an angel food cake. She lives in the shadow of the Sierra and making more connections here, I think, in terms of Mount Shasta, the harmonic convergence. For those of you who are old enough to remember the harmonic convergence, the big spiritual event that Mount Shasta was a PowerPoint for that. Sedona, Arizona, the pyramids of Egypt. I think there were seven of them globally. And I suspect Katie may have some spiritual inclinations based on some of the stuff I've learned about her. Just as a preamble to getting on Zoom here with her. She lives in the shadow of those mountains with her husband and their dog, Queso. I love that name, Queso. I see a yellow Labrador. Now, in addition to writing, Katie works as an adjunct art history professor teaching rural students from Truckee to Tecopa. Now, I don't expect you to know the geography, but that's a 500-mile spread right there. So I suspect she does this virtually. She holds a master's degree in art history, and we're going to find out who her favorite artist is as well. You know, Gustav Klimt or Degas or Rubens. Again, you can tell a lot about a person by what they value in art. She developed her chops for art at Williams College. Then she pursued her PhD in art history at UC Berkeley. She's her academic writing has been published in several journals. Her fiction, which is our main focus here, explores how far humans are willing to go to believe the unbelievable, strange but real worlds. And she also explores complex female relationships. Why are women so complex? We're going to find out here. And why are men so simple? We'll find that out too, maybe. She also runs a Substack blog called June Gloom. She writes there sporadically about creativity, culture, California, and I'll go ahead and include a link to her blog as well as her website in the episode notes. Now, she has written her one and only novel, which has caused quite a stir. Actually, she's finished her second novel, all but finished it. But her first one is called The Cloisters. The secret. This is a novel where the secret history meets Ninth House in the sinister atmospheric novel, following a circle of researchers as they uncover a mysterious deck of tarot cards and shocking secrets in New York's famed Met Cloisters. If you don't know what Met Cloisters is, I didn't know it either, but the Met Cloisters is a museum in Washington Heights neighborhood of Upper Manhattan, and it's a branch of the world-famous Metropolitan Museum of Art. Katie Hayes, congratulations on the novel and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mike, and thank you for having me.
You bet. So I have to ask, here you've got this novel that, as I said, it's caused a lot. I mean, you've gotten a lot of attention for this book. It's got movie written all over it, I think, but not that you wrote it with that in mind. But where did it come from? How did it develop? I see where the art is playing into the fiction and so on, but what gave rise to it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think for me, I am as a novelist, I'm really driven by the question, what are we capable of believing in? So whether that's a charismatic con man or tarot cards or astrology or manifesting, I'm really interested in what humans in particular are able to convince themselves of. And so really this book came from a place of asking, what if you came across a 15th century deck of tarot cards that you believed really could tell the future? And what kind of questions would that raise then about fate and free will and chance? And so that's really where I came to the book, is from an interest in looking at that perspective.
Have you ever had your tarot cards read?
I haven't, actually.
Really? Okay.
No.
I have. I've had it a couple of times. It's really interesting. Then I tried to learn how to do tarot card readings, because I thought, what a nice little thing to do on the side. And wow, was it difficult. I've given up.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
No, I've never had them read. I do have a deck of tarot cards. When I worked on the book, I obviously spent a lot of time reading about tarot and learning about tarot. And I was surprised by how easy it was to scare myself. I would occasionally give myself like a 5-card spread reading and just think to myself, oh my gosh, this just sort of freaks me out. What's in the cards? So I actually kind of steered away from it in some ways.
I get it. Some of the iconography is a little intimidating. Now, the zodiac also plays a role in this novel. What is your sign?
I am a Scorpio sun, a Virgo rising, and a Sagittarius moon.
Wow. So have you had your astrological chart done?
Yes, actually, it's a very funny story. My mother had me fairly young, and one of her best friends from law school decided to give her, for my birth as a baby gift, a birth chart reading for me. And so my mom still has, and I have listened to, this old cassette of the astrologer from 1982, the year I was born, basically reading my birth chart into a tape recorder for me to listen to when I get older. And it's kind of incredibly uncanny how on point that birth chart reading, which was done literally 2 days after I was born, has been for my entire life.
Wow. I'm a fellow Scorpio, born on a Friday the 13th, in fact, November 13th. Yeah. So I'm familiar with the sign. I think I got a lot. I've never had my chart done, but I do think I have a lot of Gemini in me. I talk a lot. I'm inquisitive and so on. Although I don't think I have a split personality. I think my wife might disagree, but I don't think of myself as having two distinct personalities. Talk about the most unbelievable thing that you believe in, or are you too grounded for that? Is there something, or maybe just a flight of fan? Maybe it's not unbelievable. Maybe it's not QAnon or something bizarre, but maybe you have your own flights of fancy, perhaps.
You know, what I think is interesting is that as an adult, I'm very practical and very grounded. But when I was younger, particularly in elementary school and junior high and high school, I was really, really interested in things like herb gardens and witches walks and just old practices around the occult that I was really fascinated by as a young person. And so I think a lot of that, despite the fact I am very practical, I think a lot of that fascination has carried over with me. And, you know, as you mentioned, I'm a Californian. I have really deep roots in the Bay Area and in Los Angeles County. And, you know, one of the things that I find myself most interested in, but perhaps not always believing in, is kind of the rise of new spiritualism around things like astrology and manifesting and even tarot reading. And I'm really interested in the way that those practices are being repackaged and used today.
Now, do you have any spiritual practices that you adhere to? I don't know if you're a meditator, if you do any chanting, if you do meditative walks, perhaps. Go ahead.
You know, I was raised Episcopalian. So I still consider myself to be Episcopalian. I'm not the kind of Christian, though, I think, who believes that there's only one path to enlightenment or spiritual connection. I think a lot of Episcopalians, we tend to be the most liberal of all the denominations. But for me, I'm a big yoga person. I try to go to yoga at least twice a week. And for me, I think that kind of movement and that meditative quality of of breath work during movement has been really great for me. I think like a lot of writers, I'm a fairly anxious person just in general. And so something like yoga has been really helpful. And I also, I'm a big, both in the winter and the summer, really big on getting outdoors and just moving my body. And so while I don't consider, you know, I don't go out on a bike ride or go skiing or go on a trail run thinking it's going to be meditation, I do think that kind of practice of just, you know, again, moving your body is a kind of, at least for a lot of people living in the mountains, is a kind of religion.
Yeah. You know, and I neglected to say that Katie is a skier, a cyclist, a trail runner. In addition to being an indoor person when it comes to, you know, being a reader and a writer and so on. What about, you said breath work. Do you do breath of fire?
I do. I'm really bad at Kiribati, but I do do it. I think I'm really fascinated by breath work. I'm an impatient person. So sometimes I lack the patience that good breath work requires. But when I'm in a yoga class where I'm forced to really sit with the breath work for a while, I'm really impressed by what breath work is able to accomplish.
Tell us why you write. There's a lot of people who wouldn't think of writing. There's a lot of people who try it and they give it up. It can be really onerous. Why do you write?
Do you want the honest answer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I write because I went to graduate school for art history and I live in the mountains where there aren't a lot of jobs. I teach in a field where tenure track jobs are few and far between and almost non-existent if you want to live in a place that you choose. And so I came out of grad school thinking to myself, gosh, I really don't have any other marketable skills. I mean, my marketable skills are critical thinking and writing and art history. And I really kind of, I started it when I left grad school, writing a few pieces and abandoning them and writing a few pieces and abandoning them. And I finally realized when I moved to Tahoe, I moved from the Bay Area to Tahoe in 2013, I think it was, or 2012. I've been here a decade, a little over a decade now. And I think when I moved up here, I thought to myself, I should really write, but I kind of put it on the back burner for a while.
When you say write, did you have a novel in mind when you were thinking I should write?
No, initially I thought that I would write nonfiction. I thought, you know, that's what I'm really trained in. I've obviously done a lot of academic writing. I thought I would maybe go write a biography of like Ray Ames or something, or write a book about mid-century architecture and the California Dream, or I don't know. I honestly thought I would write nonfiction. And for me, I found after years of being an academic that there was a kind of release in writing fiction, a freedom to it that I really loved and that felt almost magical to me in a way that writing nonfiction didn't feel. I think, you know, obviously I approach nonfiction from the perspective of someone who's spent a lot of time researching and being an academic. And so I'm very rigorous about my research, which can also be constricting. And I think when I sat down and started writing fiction for the first time, I actually felt that there was a great deal of freedom in the practice. And I think that's what drew me to it. But really, I started writing because ultimately, Mike, I didn't think there was anything else I could do. I mean, as an academic, you're kind of, you know, once you wash out of academia, there aren't that many great options. And so to me, as a huge, I've always been a kind of fanatical reader. I grew up without television my entire childhood. My parents didn't get cable. We had like an old pair of rabbit ears on our TV my entire childhood. And I didn't get cable till I was basically heading to college. And as a result, I grew up pretty much only reading. And so I, as a huge reader, it felt like a natural place for me to move into.
This is one of the best things parents can do for their kids is, if not get rid of a TV, at least really limit it and make sure mm-hmm. that they occupy themselves with, well, whether it's reading or at least figuring out ways to do things and to occupy themselves. So kudos to your parents. What writing challenges all of us. What is the biggest challenge for you when it comes to writing, particularly the fiction writing?
You know, I think there are two really big challenges. I'm kind of encountering one right now as my teaching semester starts back up. I think the big challenge for me is I still teach full time. So I teach anywhere from 5 to 7 courses a semester, which is above or at a full teaching load. And I still work full time and have to find the time to write. And I think for me, one of the big practical challenges is having a day job that shares space with my writing brain. So I obviously, when I'm teaching or I'm writing lectures or I'm doing like schoolwork, I'm using the part of my brain that I also use to write fiction. And so I do think that one of the things I have to manage is balancing my output and finding a way that I still have energy to write. I often find that I'm an early morning person, so I often get up around 5 and write from 5 to 8 or 5 to 9. And then I put it away for the day and turn to my teaching work. But, you know, I think the balance of working full time and being a writer is a real challenge. And I know a lot of writers say that it can be liberating. I, to be honest, would love to just have free time to write and read and not have to also teach, but I'm definitely not there yet. And I think that I also like the structure of teaching. And I think outside of the practical side of things, I think the biggest challenge for me personally as a writer is kind of stripping back the layers. I'm a big drafter. I write a lot of drafts. I usually write anywhere from 8 to 12 drafts of a book before I feel like it's at a point where I would want to show it to somebody. And I usually write those drafts from the ground up. I don't look at the draft. I basically throw it away, at least for the first 5 drafts. Wow. I kind of throw the draft away and then start over. Wow. And just assume that whatever's good will make it into the next draft, which is incredibly inefficient and I don't recommend. So I think for me, that's really my other, outside of the kind of practicalities of balancing work and art, that's my other really big challenges. I like to do a lot of drafts to kind of strip away the story to what I really want it to be. And that takes time and effort and can be very inefficient.
So what is that? What would you call the molting process like when you go from, I mean, maybe you've, like you say, thrown it away, but what is the last final draft of a chapter versus the first draft? What has changed? What kind of refinements have been made?
Oh my gosh. In almost every case, the first chapter doesn't exist anymore.
Is the first effort overwritten?
Yeah. Usually the first effort is completely overwritten. And it always depends on the book. I should say, before I sold The Cloisters, I actually wrote a novel that was the novel that landed me my agent. So before The Cloisters, I wrote a book, queried it, signed with my agent, and that book died on submission. It didn't get acquired. And I then started writing The Cloisters. And I've now finished a draft of what will be the novel probably that comes after The Cloisters. And in my experience now, 3 books in, I will say that every book is different. So in some books, maybe a sentence or two survives. In other books, nothing at all survives. I've moved books from epistolary to fully first person. I've moved books from omniscient third to close third. I've, you know, completely killed characters and come up with new ones. For me, I think I like, as inefficient as it is, I like the process of that kind of constant stripping away of the story, because you're ultimately left with just the few things that you think are going to survive. And once you get those, I feel like it really sets the tone of the book. And then you can adjust. Then in the revisions, you can start to adjust. And I should say, I'm the sort of writer who hates to draft, despite my iterative drafting process. I love to revise. I mean, once I have that kind of the bones of the book, the skeletal structure, that's when I'm happiest, is when I can kind of start to work the revisions to get the final project.
So you know where you're going. You've got the structure, you know where you're going. And now within those parameters, you feel that that sense of freedom and that sense of creativity.
Yeah.
Correct. So you discovered the freedom of fiction writing, but at the same time, you've written academic papers. Academic papers are the antithesis of fiction writing. So did you struggle for a while that, hey, allow myself this freedom? I've got the freedom, but I'm not actually using it because I'm still stuck on the old program?
You know, what I actually think is interesting is, and maybe it's an art history thing, maybe it's a humanities thing, but I think that I became a fiction writer in part because some of the professors I've worked with and some of the art historians I've read over the years are such beautiful writers and have such incredible writerly voices that I think there is, in a lot of art history, literature, and academic work, a kind of fiction strain that runs through it. And so I feel like I was really lucky to work with faculty and to read art historians who had very strong writerly voices. And I think for me as an academic, I was always really interested in the idea of cultivating a really distinctive voice as an academic writer. And so turning to fiction for me actually didn't feel uncomfortable at all. I felt like I had always been really invested in the concept of voice. And although I feel like my fiction voice is very different from my nonfiction voice, for me, that transition came really naturally. And I think a lot of, I suspect that it's true in the broader humanities as well. But the reality is, you know, when an art historian has to turn and look at a work of art and describe the work of art and kind of talk about the work of art, there is a flexibility or a kind of lyricism available to an art historian that there might not be in another discipline like the social sciences. And so, you know, I grew up reading, or I academically grew up, I guess you could say, reading some really incredible critics and art historians, and also some music critics. I'm a huge fan of Grail Marcus, who taught at Berkeley when I was there, and he writes beautifully about music. And I really think for me, there isn't a big distinction between academic writing and fiction writing. I think it's all, you know, the best academic writing is already cultivating a writerly voice.
Give us a deeper dive on the cloisters. What is the tale that you tell beyond the headline I just offered a little bit earlier?
Yeah, for me, the cloisters is really about the question of chance and randomness and free will and fate. So one of the things I was really interested in the book, I'll just say sort of for those listeners who may not have read it, it's the story of Anne Stillwell, who goes to work at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and is assigned to their medieval museum, the Cloisters, at the northern tip of Manhattan. And there she discovers a 15th century deck of tarot cards that she thinks might actually be able to tell the future. And for me, the book is really about kind of the questions of whether or not we are fully in charge of our fates and our futures and the outcome of our lives, and how much of it is left up to chance and how much of it is predestined for us. And I'm really interested in that from the perspective, I was always really interested in the idea that tarot as a, what is effectively a card game, right, really symbolizes this idea of chance and randomness. Because in pulling a tarot card, there's this idea that it can be completely random. It can be a matter of chance. But the flip side of that is always, but was it meant for you? Is it not chance? Because in fact, it's fate. And I'm really interested in that tension and thinking about that tension in terms of particularly female ambition and the lives we choose to build for ourselves and kind of what we want outside of our own experiences. And so for me, that's really the core of the book. It really centers on these questions around, you know, what we choose for ourselves and what the world might choose for us and how much, you know, how much is each, let's say.
Let's have you read an excerpt so that our listeners can better understand the writer's voice that you possess. Will you be starting from the prologue, or did you have some other section in mind?
I will start from the prologue. Let me see here. Okay. I'm just going to grab my copy.
Because if you were going to do that, I was going to at least read that first paragraph because it was really captivating.
Oh, sorry. That's my dog, by the way. Who is
that? Oh, that's fine. That's Queso.
Barking in
the, now,
that's
what breed
Queso.
Is Queso?
He's an Australian Shepherd, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's a red tri-Australian Shepherd. So I'll go ahead and read from the prologue, which is a section I love. How much would you like me to read, Mike?
Well, why don't you, I'm looking here. Why don't you just read the prologue for starters, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, great. Death always visited me in August. A slow and delicious month, we turned into something swift and brutal. The change, quick as a card trick. I should have seen it coming, the way the body would be laid out on the library floor, the way the gardens would be torn apart by the search, the way our jealousy, greed, and ambition were waiting to devour us all, like a snake eating its own tail, the Ouroboros. And even though I knew the dark truths we hid from one another that summer, some part of me still longs for the cloisters, for the person I was before. I used to think it might have gone either way, that I might have said no to the job or to Leo, that I might never have gone to Long Lake that summer night, that the coroner even might have decided against an autopsy. But those choices were never mine to make. I know that now. I think a lot about luck these days. Luck, probably from the Middle High German Glück, meaning fortune or happy accident. Dante called fortune the ministra di Dio, or the minister of God. Fortune, just an old-fashioned word for fate. The ancient Greeks and Romans did everything in the service of fate. They built temples in its honor and bound their lives to its caprices. They consulted sibyls and prophets. They scribed the entrails of animals and studied omens. Even Julius Caesar is said to have crossed the Rubicon only after casting a pair of dice. Iacta alia est, the die is cast. The entire fate of the Roman Empire depended on that throw. At least Caesar was lucky once. What if our whole life, how we live and die, has already been decided for us? Would you want to know if a roll of the dice or a deal of the cards could tell you the outcome? Can life be that thin, that disturbing? What if we are all just Caesar, waiting on our lucky throw, refusing to see what waits for us in the Ides of March? It was easy at first to miss the omens that haunted the cloisters that summer, the gardens always spilling over with wildflowers and herbs, terracotta pots planted with lavender, and the pink lady apple tree blooming sweet and white. The air so hot, our skin stayed damp and flushed. An inescapable future that found us, not the other way around. An unlucky throw, one that I could have foreseen if only I, like the Greeks and Romans, had known what to look for.
So that's the prologue. It's a beautiful piece of writing. Then you go to chapter one. Why don't you read the first, say, a few paragraphs of chapter one? Because now the voice changes. I mean, you're starting the story in earnest now after creating a lot of symbolism there.
Yeah, sure. I would arrive in New York at the beginning of June, at a time when the heat was building, gathering in the asphalt, reflecting off the glass, until it reached a peak that wouldn't release long into September. I was going east, unlike so many of the students from my class at Whitman College who were headed west, toward Seattle and San Francisco, sometimes Hong Kong. The truth was, I wasn't going east to the place I had originally hoped, which was Cambridge or New Haven or even Williamstown. Shout out to Williams here, obviously. But when the emails came from the department chairs saying they were very sorry, a competitive applicant pool, best of luck in your future endeavors, I was grateful that one application had yielded a positive result, the Summer Associates Program at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a favor I knew to my emeritus advisor, Richard Lindgraf, who had once been something of an Ivy League luminary before the East Coast weather, or was it a questionable happening in his alma mater, had chased him west.
How did your agent respond to when he or she read the opening, say, you know, the prologue and the opening chapter? Was there excitement there?
I think so. I think she really enjoyed it. I should say that the opening chapter, the first chapter, was actually the second or third chapter in the draft she read. And the prologue has been largely intact with a few exceptions. There has always been a prologue since, I would say, the third draft. So although she read her initial read was a different draft than what is here, she did, I think, have a lot of excitement for the book immediately. And I really appreciated it's really precarious for a writer, I think, to be in a situation where their first book doesn't sell and they're kind of hoping that this next book sells and they can make their agent some money and not just be a time suck. And I think, you know, to my agent's credit, she always had a lot of enthusiasm for this book and for my work, even after my first book didn't sell. So I think she was very excited to read The Cloisters when I first sent her the draft.
Did you have a sense that you had a winner here?
No, to be honest, because I had thought that my first novel might be a winner. And so then I no longer trusted myself. And I think with The Cloisters, I thought it would be attractive because it dealt with tarot cards. And I felt like there really hadn't been any novels that took a really interesting stab at the question of tarot, particularly from a historical perspective. And I did think that catnip for editors, but it's really, really difficult to get traditionally published these days. It's incredibly competitive. There are lots of great stories. There are lots of great stories that don't get bought. So I never kind of took for granted that this was a home run at any time.
Let's talk about complex female relationships. Are female relationships naturally complex, or do you take your female characters and create complex relationships? Any relationship could be complex. Or do you think that it's kind of a natural byproduct of women's sensibilities that they create complex relationships with one another or with, the other gender as well?
I think in my experience, what happens between women is that women share much more with one another than men share with each other. And so I think with women, there is a lot more emotional candidness in a friendship. And I also think that in the case of the relationship in The Cloisters, I was interested in creating a friendship where there would also necessarily be an aspect of competition and competitiveness. And so for me, that's really my interest, is the way in which female friendships can kind of morph or mutate depending on the context of them. And I find that really interesting. In general, I'm interested in people's relationships, whether they're romantic or platonic. I don't know if you've ever listened to the podcast Normal Gossip.
I have not.
It's wonderful. I mean, it's literally just normal gossip about people's friendships and relationships, and families and coworkers. And I love that podcast because I'm really interested in, kind of eavesdropping on everybody's comments about one another. And so for me, even beyond female friendships, I'm just interested in, the complexities of human relationships in general.
Normal Gossip. I am following now. I just signed up. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So what's the relationship between cake and writing? Is there one at all? I mean, I'm not assuming that. I'm just asking, do you bake? First of all, do you bake, or are you strictly a consumer of cake?
Oh, I'm a big baker. And I would say the relationship between cake baking and writing is that when one is cake baking, one is procrastinating writing. So my husband always jokes that he can tell when I'm putting things off because there's like an elaborate layer cake in the middle of the kitchen island. And he's like, I see we are not reading the novel we're supposed to be reading today. No, so I'm a big baker. I've always been a big baker. I'm a really passionate eater of sweets and treats and all kinds of snacks. I I could never survive as one of those people who is really ascetic about the way they eat and who's like, I have a lot of friends like this who, won't eat sugar or won't eat like carbs or won't eat like dairy. And I'm one of those people who like is a voracious consumer of every food that I can get my hands on. But I have a particularly intense sweet tooth. And cakes are for me, I feel like cakes and donuts are my number one and number two. And I love to make cake. Whether it's sort of like just a really easy tea cake that comes out of a loaf tin or a bundt cake, or I make a lot of layer cakes. I bake a ton and I love all of them. We almost always have a cake on the kitchen island. So
have you ever watched the British baking show?
Yes, I love it.
So if the British baking show, if the bakers were given the assignment of baking Katie Hayes a cake for the Pulitzer Prize that she has won, what cake would you tell the administrators of that program you want them to bake?
I would want them to bake a layer cake with multiple layers, and I would want it to be a cake that is neither fruit nor chocolate, and see what they come up with.
Oh, interesting. So you want to give them a challenge. Okay.
Yeah.
But your go-to cake, do you have a go-to cake that you would eat on a regular basis?
I have quite a few. I love, if I'm actually working and I'm busy, I really love to make like a lemon poppy seed tea cake with like a nice lemon glaze. That's one of my kind of favorite, very easy cakes to make if I just want something on the kitchen counter. I love, because I get up very early, I usually stop working around 3 p.m. if I can, so that then I can turn my attention to kind of walking the dog and enjoying my afternoon. And often that's when I will like have a cup of coffee and a slice of cake. And so I love to have like just a lemon poppy seed loaf on the counter or something with citrus, like an orange, like an olive oil orange loaf often. But if I have more time, my actual preferred, if it's my sort of ideal cake, I love a layer cake. And I really, just even a simple two cake layers, frosting in the middle, frosting on the top and the sides. And I, make a pumpkin cake that I really love and a chocolate cake that I really love.
So you're on the British baking show, let's say, and it's going to be a cake. You have to bake a cake, but it's a cake of your choice. What is your go-to cake in terms of if you're going to wow the judges, what would you bake?
Oh, okay. Well, I would never ever go on a cooking competition show because I love to cook and I love to bake and I would never want to be in an environment that made me hate it. So, but often if I'm going to a friend's birthday party in the summer, I always make an angel food cake with strawberries and whipped cream layered inside of it. So that's if it's summer, that's what I'm making. If it's winter, I'm probably going to make a pumpkin cake with a cheesecake, with a cream cheese frosting.
Mm. So, both sound absolutely delicious. Why do you live in the Sierras?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I grew up in the Bay Area and I went to school at UC Santa Cruz. I lived in Santa Cruz for a long time. I loved it. I moved to the East Coast thinking that I wanted to move to the East Coast and go to grad school there. I spent 2 years in Massachusetts at Williams and was like, get me out of here immediately. I cannot do East Coast weather at all. And so I promptly came back to Berkeley. I think I would have just sobbed hysterically if I hadn't been able to come home to Berkeley. But I love the Bay Area, but it has changed so dramatically in the past, let's say 15 years, or really since like 2006 or seven. And I just didn't like the way it had changed. I felt like it was really hard to get around. The traffic was bad. All of the kind of outdoor places I wanted to go had become really crowded suddenly. And so I decided to move to Tahoe because I'm a big skier. I'm a big mountain biker. I'm a big trail runner. I like to road bike. And it just seemed, at the time I joked that it was kind of like the Bay Area light. And now after COVID, it feels a little bit more like the Bay Area heavy, which is a little hard. you know, you leave the Bay Area for a reason, and then Tahoe basically in the course of, you know, 6 months becomes what you left, which can be difficult. But that is kind of why I moved to Tahoe. I wanted to still be in Northern California, but I wanted to have a little bit more of a rural existence than I was having in the Bay Area. So that's so why
are you in Tahoe proper?
I'm in Olympic Valley. So I am, like, as I sit here talking to you now, I'm a mile from the Palisades Tahoe chairlifts.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So your husband's from upstate New York, right?
He sure is. Yeah.
I'm from upstate New York. I'm from Endicott, New York, the Binghamton area. Where's your husband from?
He's from just north of Saratoga Springs.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Like in between Saratoga Springs and Corinth in this very small town called Porter Corners.
How did you decide? Are you an artist yourself other than writing? Are you a fine artist? Why did you go into art history? Did you paint? Did you sculpt? Or were you just attracted to art?
You know, it's a, I'm not an artist. I come from a really interesting family in that everyone in my family either becomes like a doctor or a lawyer or a creative. There's really no in between. So for example, my grandmother was an artist. My cousin is a cinematographer and does like director photography work in LA, and is a director. I'm obviously a writer, but my brother, for example, is a lawyer like my parents. And so I'm not a visual artist at all. I really appreciate it. And actually, when I was in college, I thought I would become an attorney like my parents. And so I was majoring in history and I was required to fulfill an arts requirement. I was in my junior year. I was preparing at that time, kind of deciding if I was going to apply to history PhD programs or go to law school. And I had to take an arts requirement. And so I signed up for an art history class, like an upper division art history class, and fell so thoroughly in love with the work that I stayed an extra year at UC Santa Cruz to also get a major in art history after finishing my history major. And I, at that point too, had kind of realized that law school wasn't going to be for me and decided instead of applying to history PhD programs that I would apply to a PhD program in art history instead.
So who is your favorite artist?
I'm a big fan personally of an artist by the name of Camille Pissarro. He is a French impressionist, but not really a well-known one. He worked alongside the impressionists. He's primarily a landscape painter. And so for me, it's Camille Pissarro all the way.
And what does that say about you? That his work is what you really connect with more than any other artist? Does that reveal anything about you?
Maybe. I think Pissarro's work is deeply elegiac. Like there's a kind of sorrowful quality or kind of grieving quality to a lot of Pissarro's landscapes. And so while we often think of impressionism as like very pretty and fluffy and these sort of fat cherubic women or kind of gorgeous landscapes, Pissarro's landscapes aren't like that at all. They're very subdued and very color blocking. And so I think for me, you know, I was always really interested as a graduate student in the question of late style. It's something that Adorno writes about a lot in respect to Beethoven and music. And this idea that artists begin to mourn their lives kind of late in life. And I'm really, I think one of the great interests for me in Pissarro is this question of, you know, how he was mourning the loss of the city and the countryside he knew as France modernized. So I guess I like a bit of like bleak and depressing in my art, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. Not surprising. And that has nothing to do with you. I mean, just art, you know, you art, you expect to experience a full range of emotions with art. Although so many people, especially as they age, I notice they tend to, particularly with movies, they will start to eliminate a lot of different movies because it's sad or this or that. And it's like, oh, that's what tells you you're alive. It's what tells you you're human to feel
really,
sadness and so
that's
on.
Really funny too, because my husband and I just decided at the end of last year, we started to watch the BFI's Top 100. So every week we watch one of the BFI's Top 100 films in history and kind of do like a little bit of academic reading about the movie and then watch it. And some of them have been really hard to watch.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I get it. Talk about, actually, let me jump back to spirituality for just a minute. I mentioned the harmonic convergence. Are you even old enough to remember the harmonic convergence in the 1980s?
I wasn't old enough to remember it then, but I have read quite a bit about it in the time sense. I'm really interested in, like, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm really interested in weird shit. Like, I am really, one of my favorite things is, the Whole Earth catalog. Have you had a chance to?
Stuart Brand.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Like, obsessed with Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth catalog. Also, as a lifelong Bay Area native, very interested in kind of Stuart Brand's influence on early tech, and kind of, gosh, how that went off the rails. But no, I am not old enough to remember it, but I have thought a lot about it. And my husband and I are big backcountry skiers. So we ski up on Mount Shasta a lot in the spring and spend time up there. And it's hard to escape when you're up there.
So, let's talk about June Gloom, your Substack blog. I mean, just based on the name, I mean, tell us about the name, actually. What does the name mean? Why did you name it June Gloom?
I should really say my aspirational Substack, because I have not had time to write any essays since I've just been dealing with the book coming out and teaching this fall. But I am still intending to get around to it. I named it June Gloom because that is what the kind of foggy June is called in Los Angeles and kind of in Southern California. We also get it obviously on the coast in Northern California too. And I called it June Gloom because I think there's this kind of misapprehension for a lot of people who think about California from outside of the state, that it's a place that's always sunny and the weather's always perfect and everything's always utopic here. And, you know, I am a big reader of the New York Times, and I feel like every 6 months, the New York Times has an op-ed about why California isn't a utopia. And I feel like every Californian is just sitting there banging their head against the table going, yeah, I mean, we know that. Have you read Steinbeck? Like, have you read Joan Didion? I mean, nobody thinks this state is a utopia. It can be a real disaster. So I named the Substack June Gloom because I'm really interested in kind of the darker undersides of the state in a lot of way, and this kind of misapprehension that, you know, it's always sunny. I remember two springs ago, my in-laws were visiting from upstate New York, and they came to visit us. We were actually down in Mammoth in June, and they said, oh, we're going to go drive up Highway 1 because we want to see how beautiful it is. And, you know, I have some friends in Big Sur, and they were just like, we've just been in the fog cloud. Like, the fog has just been so bad for a week right now. And I just said that to my in-laws. I said, yeah, you just might want to check and make sure that it's not going to be foggy for your drive. And they were so taken aback at the idea that in June in California, it would be foggy on the coast. And I'm just like, yeah, this is, you know, the coast of California is cold.
Yeah.
Fall, yeah. Come in November. It's beautiful, but oh man, summers can be freezing.
What have you learned about creativity over the years, Katie?
You know, what I've learned is that it's not, you can't wait for the muse to kind of come down and grace you with her presence. I think there's this idea that you have to be in the right place. You have to have the right amount of time. You have to have the right
frame of mind to kind of get to a creative activity or a creative endeavor. And I feel like what I've learned is that it's just showing up to the practice in a consistent way, even when you don't want to, even when you don't know where the book is going, even when you would rather be doing anything else and you just feel like it's heavy lifting. I think that's when it's really important to keep working. And I think we have this kind of idea that being creative or being artistic is this thing that's bestowed on you. And I have learned that that's absolutely not the case.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be the strongest part of your writing game?
I think for me, I really thrive when it comes to writing and talking about atmosphere. Like I said, I grew up in sort of the South County in Southern Santa Clara County and kind of what was then a really rural farming community. And we did not have a television that had cable. And I didn't really go very, I mean, we went camping a lot when I was a kid, but my parents had me very young. And so we weren't, you know, taking off on elaborate trips to Europe when I was little. And I really used books as a way to travel. And so for me as a writer, one of the things that I think I love the most about writing is using writing as a way to transport the reader on a page to a world that they aren't familiar with. And that's something for me that has, that I think I do well as a writer. And I think conversely, I really struggle with character. I still do. I think character can be really difficult for me. So I think we all have strengths and weaknesses as writers.
So obviously you're also a reader. What or who do you favor when it comes to reading fiction?
I feel almost embarrassed by how much of a fan of Christopher Bolin I am. I'm a big, big fan of a writer named Christopher Bolin. He has 4 books out now. My 2 favorite are The Destroyers and A Beautiful Crime. He writes incredible, immaculately paced, upmarket literary suspense fiction. So he doesn't write thrillers. They're not mysteries. They are just, I wish I could write the way Christopher Bolin writes. He's an incredible writer. So Christopher Bolin is usually who I recommend if people are like, what are you reading that you like? So I usually recommend him. I these days have been a really big fan of everything that Rachel Hawkins has written. She writes kind of more traditional thriller style books. She wrote The Wife Upstairs, Reckless Girls, The Villa comes out today, in fact. And I love her books that I'm looking for something to kind of like break up the tedium of reading. And I'm also a really big fan of Shirley Hazzard, who is a writer, kind of, she wrote in the 70s and 80s. I'm a really big fan of her memoir writing in particular. She wrote a book called The Ancient Shore with her husband about their time in Naples. And she also wrote a memoir about Graham Greene called Green on Capri. And she also writes fiction, The Bay of Noon, The Great Fire, The Transit of Venus is what she's best known for. So I'm a pretty obsessive Shirley Hazzard fangirl as well.
Interesting. So you are, as I said at the top, you have completed or are putting the finishing touches on your next book, correct?
Yes. Let's
what
say
can you
still,
tell us about it?
Still revising. What can I tell you about it? I can tell you that it's about a family who goes on vacation and something happens on the vacation that brings up a really terrible thing that happened in their past. And so it's a book about haunting and it's a book about family mythology and family myth making. And it's also a book about what we're willing to forgive when it comes to money in a family. So that's kind of all I'm saying about it right now. I get very superstitious about talking about books while I'm working on them because I know how much books change in the revision process that it's really difficult to like pin a book down until it's actually kind of, you know, you're just doing line, sort of line revisions.
Right, right. So is this one, will they hear, the reader, will they hear Katie Hayes's voice and say, this is a familiar voice to me? Or is it going to be a complete departure, not story-wise, but voice-wise?
That's a good question. I haven't decided because I'm still working on the point of view in the book. I should say that as a writer, I love to write in first person and I love to write in third omniscient. Although it seems like these days readers and editors don't love third omniscient very much, but it is, as a reader, one of my favorite points of view, and as a writer, one of my favorite points of view. And I really struggle to write in third limited or third close, which is very common. So I'm still working on the point of view. And I think once I've decided on that, it may depend, that may be a deciding factor in how much of my voice comes through.
So talk about teaching a little bit. Do you teach virtually? And what is your methodology? How do you really connect with students? What does teaching do for you? What might be some of the challenges of teaching and so on?
So I do teach online. I teach on ground in person, or I did before COVID in Truckee in the fall. I don't teach on ground in the spring because our snow situation can be so intense that it's hard to just, I, for example, tried to drive from Olympic Valley to Truckee last week. It's a drive that should take about 12 to 15 minutes. It took me an hour and 45 minutes.
Wow.
And so the traffic can be really bad during ski season. So I don't teach on ground in the spring. I just teach online. No, so in the spring, it's hard to teach on ground. So I teach online and I teach for quite a few colleges. I teach for Sierra College, which is in Truckee, Lake Tahoe Community College, which is based in Southlake. And I also teach for Cerro Coso College, which is a college district based in Kern County that has campuses in Mammoth Lakes and Bishop as well. And so I often joke that I'm the only art historian teaching on the eastern slope of the Sierra, because I think I teach for every community college. If they have an art history class, I'm teaching it on the east side of the state. And I have found, you know, online teaching has gone through a bit of a revolution during COVID, but I had always taught online prior to COVID because when you teach for rural colleges, a lot of my students live upwards of 50 to 100 miles from the closest campus. And so online delivery was always a kind of important modality for those colleges long before COVID. And for me, it's been a really interesting process. I obviously still teach on ground too, but it's been really interesting to teach online. And, you know, I really love and enjoy my work. I think I like the structure it gives me. It can be challenging to kind of share your mind space with a job that you have to perform and writing as a creative endeavor. And I think, you know, teaching though has been really fun. And for me, I think when teaching online, I think it's really important to keep students engaged on a project basis. So when I teach online, I actually have my students curate exhibitions. So they choose 10 to 15 works of art on a topic. They propose the exhibition. They do a gallery plan layout for the exhibition. They write all their wall labels. They write historical context labels and labels about the media used. And I found that when teaching online, that kind of project where you're working on something really creative and fun that you have a lot of control over as a student has been a great way to manage the otherwise, like the frustrations and the kind of anonymity that comes with teaching online.
Hmm. Interesting. So final question, knowing what you know now, what would you advise a 25-year-old Katie Hayes to do or know?
You know, it's pretty funny. Part of me, my knee-jerk reaction when you said that was to say, write the novel that you started at 25. Because obviously at 25, I had half of a novel written that I never finished and never went back to. But I also think that ultimately, to be honest, academia isn't a great environment in which to learn to be really professional. And I don't say that in any kind of harsh or mean way. I think the thing is, academia is a very sheltered environment. And I think it's easy to stay in academia and not kind of have to learn how to respond to email in a responsive way and not have to kind of work in a way that's functional with the rest of the world. And so I'm really grateful that when I left academia, I had an opportunity to kind of start working outside of the university and then came back to it. And I think that, you know, ultimately I'm much better equipped now to be writing than I was back then. So in all honesty, Mike, I think that, I mean, it goes back to the book's theme, I suppose. I think in some ways, all of these sort of stages and steps that we work our way through are meant to be there as we work towards what was always waiting for us. So I don't think I would do anything different.
I get it. I get it. You know, I actually do have one other question, because the name of your book, the title is The Cloisters. Cloister or cloistered is a real word in the English language. Is the title a double entendre?
Only in so much as the place itself is a double entendre in the book. Obviously, the cloisters, I do have a passage in the book where Anne ruminates on the fact that they're at the cloisters and they're also locked away from the city itself. And so I think it's a play on words insofar as the museum itself is just sort of accidentally a play on words in the city of New York.
Well, Katie Hayes, congratulations on the cloisters. We look forward to your next novel. And thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much, Mike. I hope you have a great afternoon.